Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. My name is Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com, also at alexlinder.com. Today we're going to do the briefest chapter in the entire book, The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit and Its Impact on World History, by E. Michael Jones of culturewars.com. It's called Folk Music Meets the Civil Rights Movement. More of the stuff we were hearing two chapters ago. This is only about four pages. Now, why he has these 90-page chapters and then he has a four-page chapter, I don't know. He's all over the place. They're not super evenly broken up. And even the breaks between them don't particularly make sense because, like, we have one chapter that talks about Bob Dylan and National Review as a CIA front, and they're in the same chapter. So if you're going to have four-page chapters, why not split that up? I don't know. Anyway, this uses the same sources we've heard earlier, so we won't bother with that. We'll just go into it and read it. Folk Music Meets the Civil Rights Movement, Chapter 25. In 1963, the personal became political, or politics became personal. In February of that year, that's an old leftist saying, the personal is political. In February of that year, Ron Radosh's wife gave birth to their first child, but the arrival of that child did not help their marriage, which, in distinction to his exciting intellectual life, involved constant bickering and fighting. Radosh repressed the recurring thought that they should never have married by throwing himself into what we were beginning to call the movement and into folk music. By this point in time, that movement was defined more by Freud than by Marx. When Radosh's wife insisted they undergo therapy, Radosh didn't know how to say no because, quote, besides Marxism, our other chosen ism was Freudianism, which we thought could do for the individual psyche what Marx could do for society. So Radosh and his wife made a weekly pilgrimage to Chicago, where a cut-rate shrink named Alan Robertson initiated them into the mysteries of sleep therapy, something, quote, that allowed the patient to reach the deepest levels of the unconscious. This particular form of therapy involved Robertson charging Radosh and his friends for the naps they took in his office, during which Robertson also napped. Needless to say, the therapy didn't help Radosh's marriage. When his wife developed a, quote, serious medical problem, she moved back to New York to her family. The personal became political for Bob Dylan, too. On May 2, 1963, Gene Shea picked up Dylan and his girlfriend Susie Rotolo at the 30th Street Station in Philadelphia and drove them to Tossie Aaron's home, T-O-S-S-I, in Cheltenham, where they rested in anticipation of Dylan's concert the following day at the Ethical Society building on Rittenhouse Square. The release of Freewheelin' Bob Dylan, with Susie on the cover, was a month away, but Dylan and Susie were already having problems. Dylan had met Joan Baez and they had fallen in love, she with his music and he with her career. An affair ensued and a concert tour followed. On tour, Joan Baez would sing a few songs and then invite Dylan on stage, where he stole the show. The culmination of the affair and the tour was the 1963 Newport Folk Festival, where Dylan was inducted into the folk music pantheon. A picture shows Dylan linking arms with Peter Paul and Mary, Baez, Odetta, Pete Seeger, and Theodore Bickel, all singing We Shall Overcome, with an unidentified Negro representative of the Civil Rights Movement, or plural reps of the movement. Bob's legendary mystique took a major hit shortly after that festival when an article entitled I Am My Words appeared in Newsweek. The article exposed Dylan's roots as a Jew named Zimmerman from the Midwest. He could no longer deny the existence of his parents because they had been seen at his recent concert at Carnegie Hall. People with middle-class Jewish parents from the Midwest didn't arrive in New York City in boxcars, certainly not in 1963. According to Spitz, Dylan flew into a rage because he had been unmasked as a fraud. The unmasking, however, would have little effect because by this time Robert Shelton had become a member of Dylan's entourage, hanging out, drinking, and partying with Dylan and Grossman. Shelton still had the New York Times at his disposal to repair Dylan's myth whenever it was threatened by impious outsiders. Shelton accused Newsweek of a hatchet job on Dylan, and that laid the roots issue and the issue of Dylan's truthfulness about those roots to rest. Actually, what the New York Times defense of Dylan did was simply repress the truth so that the protest which it fueled would appear in another form. The success of Peter, Paul, and Mary ensured that a reaction would occur, especially when one of the biggest hits of 1963 was their cover of If I Had a Hammer, a song which HUAC, House Un-American Activities Committee, condemned as communist-inspired in 1955. So they have a hit in 63 on that same thing. In 1963, millions of high school students from San Diego up to Maine, in every town and mill, that's a quote, maybe a lyric, were singing it. Pete Seeger had been sentenced to prison for writing the song, and now Albert Grossman and his protégés were making millions off it. Some people interpreted the situation as a sign of how far the country had fallen. We're on page 900 now. 1077 of text. In summer 1963, Pete Seeger showed up to perform in Los Angeles, only to be denounced by the Fire and Police Research Association of Los Angeles, Inc., for using folk songs as an unidentified tool of communist psychological or cybernetic warfare to ensnare and capture youthful minds. Perhaps sensing folk music had become a leading tourist attraction, New York Senator Kenneth Keating denounced the California cops and firefighters, announcing he was, quote, stunned by the revelation that folk music is part of the communist arsenal of weapons. Keating labored under, quote, the impression it was thoroughly American in spirit, it was American folk music, indicating that he was either naive or pandering for the Jewish vote in Manhattan. Jer Real, spelled J-E-R-E-R-E-A-L, Jer Real, writing for the John Birch Society periodical American Opinion, disabused Keating of any naivete. Folk music, according to Real, was a very subtle but highly effective presentation of standard Communist Party propaganda, in spite of, or perhaps because of, the hand-clapping, the guitar strumming, the banjo picking, the shouting, and the howling accompanying it. As a result, quote, not since the 1930s have so many people of the United States been so directly, so cleverly, deceived into a widespread parroting of the communist line. The Birch Society was right about the subversion, but as usual, they were wrong about who was subverting whom. Even party hacks like Irwin Silber, still editor of Sing Out in 1963, had resigned from the Communist Party in 1958. The Birchers failed to understand that people like Silber were revolutionaries not because they were communist, but because they were Jewish folk singers. The right had always a difficult time in distinguishing between form and content, and the part and the whole. The form in this instance was the revolutionary Jew. The revolutionary content was no longer communism, it was folk music. What the communists construed as a vehicle for popular front-era propaganda had taken on a life of its own. The party no longer directed the revolution, nor did it define its content. People like Dylan did that, based on not on any party line, but on the lives they were leading, as seen through the lens of the ancestral Jewish penchant for revolutionary activity. Bob Dylan was not a communist, but he was a revolutionary Jew, and as such, he could redefine the revolution to meet the needs of the zeitgeist, which, as Norman Mailer, another revolutionary Jew, announced in his essay, The White Negro, were increasingly sexual. Right-wing critics. Other right-wing critics were equally obtuse. Rather than risk accusations of anti-Semitism, they beat the dead horse of communism. In The Marxist Minstrels, a handbook on communist subversion of music, David Nobel wrote, the communist infiltration into the subversion of American music has been nothing short of phenomenal, and in some areas, e.g. folk music, their control is fast approaching the saturation point under the able leadership of Pete Seeger. Sing Out, Folkways Records, and Oak Publications, Inc. 3 years earlier, Serge Denisov, in his book Great Day Coming, had documented, quote, the old left's discovery and use of folk song materials. Irwin Silber could resign from the Communist Party, but he never stopped being a revolutionary Jewish folk singer, and that was precisely the persona which the revolutionary Jew adopted when it got tired of defending the largely irrelevant dogma emanating from Moscow in the years after Khrushchev denounced Stalin. Music may well have continued to be a vehicle for revolution, but the revolution was not communism, nor was it run by commissars from Moscow. It was run by the children of the commissars from Moscow, who now considered themselves Americans, largely because of all the folk music they had played at summer camp. The Royces explained the fate of the revolutionary Jew when he made contact with American folk music, but only obliquely when they say that, quote, to the extent that participants in the communist movement came from recent immigrant stock, absorbing American folk song and folklore is one way to assimilate into American society. So communism didn't, in the final analysis, subvert folk music. Folk music subverted communism. The real continuity was ethnic, not political. The revolutionary Jew would redefine the revolution to suit his needs, even if he destroyed himself in the process. The summer of 63 was folk music's moment of glory, and nothing epitomized that moment more than the duets of Joan Baez and Bob Dylan. Those duets also, unfortunately, signaled the end of Dylan's relationship with Susie Rotolo. The lady who marched down the Great Jones Street, adoringly hanging on Dylan's arm, was now history, in more than one sense of the word. After Dylan left his concert tour with Baez, Rotolo moved out of their apartment and got a job working as a waitress at a luncheonette on 12th Street. Rotolo was now finished with Dylan, or so she thought, until she discovered that she was pregnant. Bob Dylan dealt with his paternity by having Albert Grossman arrange for an illegal abortion at a doctor's office on the Upper East Side. It was a defining moment for Dylan, and for the movement he would lead. The emotional clarity of ballads like Don't Think Twice would now become muddied by a torrent of surrealistic imagery. The imagery of songs like Mr. Tambourine Man are usually incorrectly traced back to drugs, but the increased use of drugs is rarely traced back to one of its most common functions, namely anesthesia, specifically anesthesia of conscience. Bob Dylan was notoriously cruel with anyone around him. His favorite targets were folk singers who admired him, people like Eric Anderson and Phil Oakes, who idolized Dylan in spite of the abuse he took at his hands. Eventually, Dylan turned on Joan Baez as well during their tour of England. Dylan and his buddy Bobby Neuwirth ridiculed Baez so mercilessly, some of which is caught in the Panabaker film Don't Look Back, that she eventually dropped out of the tour. That is the way that Dylan repaid her kindness in fostering his career a few years earlier. As a result, Dylan's music began to take on the characteristics of his deformed soul. The music became harsh and electronically amplified, and the lyrics became increasingly opaque as Dylan fell more and more under the influence of degenerates like the beat poet Allen Ginsberg, whose poetry mirrored an equally depraved soul. Since the people who bought his records were undergoing the same sort of moral degeneration, each innovation in his music was greeted as an artistic breakthrough. End page 902, the end of the chapter 25, very, very brief chapter. So Dylan essentially uses these people and then quickly dumps them as he assumes the lead of this movement. Old left transformed into new left. It goes from economics, communist party line to folk singing and music and lifestyle after World War II, after Soviets break with the Nazis. And then you have Stalin dying, and you have Khrushchev denouncing Stalin. So they turn more to lifestyle stuff, Frankfurt School stuff. Sexual liberation is promoted through the new cultural genres they create and promote. Folk singing, for example. And isn't it funny that even a Jew, Eric Weisberg, is the one behind dueling banjos? He mentioned that two chapters ago. All right, thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you with chapter 26 real soon.